Okay, welcome to the show. This is the Michael Slate Show. That was Sandy Nelson with Let There Be Drums. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We have a lot on the table for you today. Actually, a lot of stuff that's not so much exciting as it is enraging. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, about living in a world of rape and sexual assault. As this show is airing in the vicinity of the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day, and we're constantly told how liberated and free women are here in America, it's important that we try to ground ourselves in reality. But before that, and for most of the show, we're going to be spending a good part of the hour talking about a new book that's out there. And that book is The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And in the second segment of the show, we'll be talking with investigative journalist Lance Tapley. Lance is a contributor to this anthology, and he'll be talking about torture inside America's supermax prisons. But kicking the show off, and I have to tell you, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my first guest. Her name is Marjorie Cohn. She's been on the show a number of other times. She's the editor of The United States and Torture. Now, Marjorie is also a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and the past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Michael.
Why don't we start out with just real quick giving people a sense of the book? You know, as I said, your book is The United States and Torture. Give people a sense of what they'll find in this book and why you felt so compelled to pull it together.
Well, it covers basically three areas. First, the history and character of torture. Second, torture and cruel treatment of prisoners in U.S. custody. And finally, accountability for torture. And the history and character of torture includes chapters by an historian, a lawyer, a political scientist, looking at the history of CIA torture and U.S. complicity throughout Latin America in torture by those regimes. And then a philosopher analyzes the ticking time bomb scenario, disabuses the notion that that is a real scenario. And then a lawyer talks about parallels between torture and one-sided warfare. And this is actually a very provocative chapter by Richard Falk, who critiques the liberal moral outrage at torture, but the uncritical acceptance of one-sided warfare. And nations, particularly the United States, inflict horrific pain on primarily non-white people in other countries, but suffer no consequences. And he draws an analogy between the torture victim and the subjects of one-sided warfare, both under the total control of the perpetrator. Then the next section talks about the U.S. torture program and the Bush administration's extraordinary rendition program. Jane Mayer from The New Yorker has a chapter talking about extraordinary rendition, where a person is abducted without any legal proceedings, transferred to a foreign country for detention and interrogation, often tortured. And this is something that happens quite a bit. It happened quite a bit during the Bush administration, and in fact, the favored country for rendition to send prisoners, the CIA to send prisoners to a country where they would be well tortured so that they could be interrogated, is Egypt under the Mubarak regime. Then the role that psychologists played in the Bush torture program is set forth by one of the leaders of the movement to end that involvement. And then Lance Tapley, who's going to be speaking to you a little bit later, talks about torture right here in the USA in the supermax prisons. And of course, Bradley Manning has been tortured, and I'm sure that Lance will talk about that. The final section, Accountability for Torture, talks about strategies for bringing to justice the Bush officials and lawyers, the torture lawyers who wrote the torture memos, the legal mercenaries. And then a sociologist rounds out the book with links between torture, war, and presidential power. The reason that I decided to pull together this collection of essays was because as the Bush administration proceeded during those 8 years, I became increasingly outraged, as did many others, about the torture and abuse that was going on and the fact that it was government policy, that it was set at the top by the officials and with their lawyers, advising them on how to torture and get away with it and not be prosecuted. And I did quite a bit of writing, essays. I wrote the Cowboy Republic book, which talked about torture as well, and did a lot of media. But then it occurred to me that we needed more different angles on it, and that's why I pulled together this interdisciplinary anthology, hoping that it will speak to many different kinds of people about this outrage that has been perpetrated in our name.
And I think it really does, as I was saying. And one thing I'd say, though, I read Richard Falk's piece, and I really admire Richard and have had him on the show many times, and find him always to be coming at things from a very deep perspective and a very sharp perspective that generally sides with the people. And at the same time, though, in the sense of this moral outrage or the liberal outrage and this question of what he calls wars of choice and all this other stuff about the, you know, the actual one-sided wars that are going on that the U.S. is waging in the world and people not coming out enough against that. You know, one of the things I was thinking about in relation to that, though, was that really, and this is what struck me in this book, because I read the essays in this book, in your book, and I learned so much. And I'm not somebody who is like ignorant of what's going on with torture or what they're doing in the world and have followed this quite a bit and covered it a lot. But I still, just the scope and the intensity and all of the things that have been done that are just absolutely outrageous violations of every human rights law ever thought of, ever conceived of, has just been tossed in the trash can in the name of allowing the U.S. to do this torture regimen. And this is the thing that gets me, is that I don't think there's enough outrage, you know, liberal or otherwise, around torture. And as you say, it's never really been out of the picture in U.S. history, but it's taken a real leap since 9/11, since 2001.
No, absolutely. I mean, torture in this country goes back at least to the 19th century, where slaves were often whipped and tortured in other ways. And the United States frequently aids and abets repressive regimes that have tortured and abused their people. The CIA developed a torture manual. One of the chapters by Bill Quigley, who's the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, talks about the School of the Americas, which has now been cosmetically renamed WINSEC. It's in Fort Benning, Georgia. And at that school, which is still open despite protests to close it, many, many vicious dictators and military leaders, especially from Latin America, have been trained in the art of torture in the United States. And in fact, graduates of the School of the Americas have assassinated bishops, priests, labor leaders, women, children, community workers. And in that same vein, political scientist Professor Terry Carl from Stanford writes a chapter about, she's an expert on El Salvador. She testifies as an expert witness in the Salvador torture trials. And she documents how thousands of people were tortured and murdered by the government and death squads of El Salvador while the United States was training, financing, and advising the government. And then she describes how the United States uses what she calls deniability to cover up state terror by its allies, refashioning them into freedom fighters in order to maintain the support of the American people. And one other thing that I want to mention is the preface, which is written by Sister Diana Ortiz, who is a Catholic nun who went down to Guatemala in the 80s to live out her life and teach the children English. And she was doing missionary work. And that's when the United States was supporting the vicious dictatorship in Guatemala. She was abducted and horribly tortured, and she describes it. And she survived that torture. She escaped. And by the way, it wasn't just torture by the Guatemalan government. There was an American that was leading the charge down there as she was being tortured. And she escaped, and she came back to the United States and founded the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition International. She's become a national symbol of the struggle to abolish torture, and she starts out with a very compelling preface.
We're talking with Marjorie Cohn, the editor of a terrific new anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Yeah, Marjorie, I felt pretty much the same about Sister Diana Ortiz's preface. Reading this essay, really, this preface really, really drove some things home, and including the fact that she talked about that the conclusion she came to is that torture actually has very little to do with getting information and has a lot more to do with absolute control, establishing absolute control and fear, not just over the individual who's being tortured, but over whole populations. And I thought that really ties into some of this question of morality of torture that's explored in the philosopher's essay. And I'd like to ask you about that. There's always this question of, well, what if you have the ticking time bomb? What if it gets information that can prevent things like that? And then the question is posed very sharply, even as you put it in the book, well, the argument that the point that's made around the morality of torture is that, well, really, it's immoral because it doesn't work. It doesn't really get any information. And you pose the question a little bit differently. You say, what if it did work? Would that make it okay?
Yeah, it's that's an interesting hypothetical, but in fact, we never know if it works because it's well established that people will say anything to get the torture to stop. For example, Sheikh al-Libi, who is described in Jane Mayer's chapter, who had ties with al-Qaeda, and he was tortured, and in fact, he was tortured and he was sent by the CIA to Egypt, and tortured in Egypt, and because they wanted to create, Bush wanted to create a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and wanted to show that Saddam Hussein was giving chemical and biological weapons to the terrorists in order to justify his illegal war in Iraq. And so al-Libi was tortured in Egypt. He gave that information, made that connection, and even though the CIA knew that it was false at the time, and Colin Powell, in that famous speech before the UN Security Council when he was urging them to pass a resolution authorizing U.S. war on Iraq, referred to the interrogation of al-Libi. Later, al-Libi recanted, and he later died under mysterious circumstances. But back to this issue of whether torture works and you know, kind of weighing different moral scenarios, the show 24, which fortunately is no longer on, but which was a very popular show, my kids loved it, a lot of people I know watched it, was on Fox, and it was produced by people very close to the Bush administration, specifically for the purpose of trying to convince Americans that torture was okay, that torture was going to get the bad guy and save, you know, millions of lives. And in fact, that ticking time bomb scenario presupposes, number one, that we know who the terrorist is, who knows where the ticking time bomb is, and number two, if we torture him, he will tell us where it is. And number three, it will save lives. And none of those things have ever proved to be valid. It's a fantasy, this ticking time bomb scenario. And this is explored in John Lango's chapter. He's a philosopher from Hunter College in New York, that the Convention Against Torture, which is a treaty, which is part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, when the U.S. ratifies a treaty, becomes part of U.S. law. It's called the Convention Against Torture. And the Convention Against Torture says that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, including a state of war, can ever be used as a justification for torture. In other words, there is no scenario ever that can justify torture. And John Lango explains that very well in his chapter.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Marjorie Cohn, who's the editor of a really great new anthology called The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. It's a wonderful book. People should really pick this up quickly. Take it out. Get it out to schools. Get it out to your neighborhoods. Get it out to your family. Have everybody read this. It's really an essential book to judge what's going on in the world and being able to actually walk through the world in a way that serves people, that is on the side of people and not on the side of just this dehumanization. And that seems to be so rampant now. And that's what I want to get back into, Marjorie, which is this thing of even the question of morality. I think it's really important. It's absolutely essential that people do recognize that whether torture worked or not, there's absolutely nothing that can justify that. This is actual total dehumanization. When you think about that, it's what you're saying. That's part of the basis that at least formally, because everybody knows there's torture, you document, in fact, very well, the Shah of Iran. And I had a lot of friends who were Iranian revolutionaries back then who suffered under Sabak and the CIA and the Shah. You document very well what it means, how all these regimes have tortured people endlessly. And even though in the world, just across the board, laws, treaties, all kinds of things saying it is never acceptable to torture people. And I think that contradiction between it's never acceptable and what actually goes on gave a little bit of room for people like John Yoo and Jay Bybee in service of the Bush regime to find the ways to justify torture.
Yes, they wrote the so-called torture memos, which tried to redefine torture much more narrowly than our law that defines torture. You had to practically kill someone. They had to have organ failure or equivalent of organ failure in order for it to constitute torture. The thing that they really glossed over was that not only is torture illegal under our laws, but also cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is illegal. One of the favorite torture techniques of the Bush administration was waterboarding. And waterboarding is a technique where a detainee is placed on a board with his kind of a slanted down, his head is slanted down, sometimes his face is covered with a cloth, and then water is poured into his nose and his mouth, and he's lucky if he doesn't drown, but he does everything but drown. It has long been recognized as torture by U.S. courts. The United States prosecuted Japanese leaders after World War II for waterboarding as torture, and yet Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and John Yoo have all said recently that they think waterboarding's fine and they would do it again. And again, Bush trying to make this connection, create a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, which never was made. The CIA waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times and Abu Zubaydah 83 times. And so eventually they confessed to al-Qaeda targeting just about every building in the world. Their information was virtually worthless. And that's another example of how people will say anything to get the torture to stop. Also, the ACLU has obtained new documents which show that 190 detainees in Bush's so-called war on terror died in U.S. custody. At least 25 or 30 of them were unjustified homicides, in other words, murder. And General Barry McCaffrey said, quote, "We tortured people unmercifully. We probably murdered dozens of them during the course of that, both the armed forces and the CIA." So, I mean, they admit it. The administration admits it. And I think one of the things that's very important, and before I move on to Obama, I want to say something that I found interesting in Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, where he recounts a conversation that occurred between CIA Director Michael Hayden as he was leaving office and Leon Panetta, Obama's CIA director who was coming into office. And this is what Hayden said to Panetta, his successor, quote, "I've read some of your writings while you've been out of government. Don't ever use the words CIA and torture in the same paragraph again. Torture is a felony, Leon. Say you don't like it. Say it offends you. I don't care, but just don't say it's torture. It's a felony." So this, I thought that was just astounding that he said that and that we actually know that. But moving to Obama.
Just a minute. Before you move to Obama, I have one other question around Bybee and you, because there's something in your introduction that you posed very sharply in a way that I just had not thought about it before. And the point that their memos were about saying that the Department of Justice would construe U.S. criminal laws as not applicable to the president's detention and interrogation of enemy combatants. And then you say, according to Bybee and you, the federal statutes against torture, assault, maiming, and stalking do not apply to the military in the conduct of war. You make a point right after that where you say, listen, the behavior that's described there is absolutely appalling. And then you go on to describe it. And I think it would really do people well to understand, what is the behavior tied up in something like maiming? What is the kind of behavior that they're saying, well, it's okay to do that. We don't have to pay attention to the laws all over the world that say, no, this isn't allowed.
Right. The federal maiming statute that John Yoo didn't want to enforce against people who were committing torture makes it a crime for someone with the intent to torture, maim, or disfigure, to cut, bite, or slit the nose, ear, or lip, or cut out or disable the tongue, or put out or destroy an eye, or cut off or disable a limb or any member of another person. And it also prohibits people from throwing or pouring upon another person any scalding water, corrosive acid, or caustic substance. It's unbelievable, A, that human beings could treat each other that way, and B, that they could get away with it.
A quick reminder, we're talking with Marjorie Cohn, who's the editor of the anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And it's a collection of essays by many, many, many people about the United States and torture.
And that brings me to Obama.
Exactly.
Who is, under the Constitution, has a duty to see that the laws are faithfully enforced, to take care that the laws are faithfully enforced. It's called the Take Care Clause. And yet, he has made it a policy, and his attorney general has gone along with this, Eric Holder, not to investigate any of the officials or lawyers from the Bush administration for torture. And by the way, torture, I should say, is considered to be a war crime under the U.S. War Crimes Act. And so we have no accountability at all for this torture regime, this policy that was established at the top, where officials and lawyers knew that the CIA interrogators would take action based upon their policies that they approved, and yet there is no accountability. Obama has basically turned his head the other way. Now, Manfred Nowak, who is the former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, said that to his knowledge, the torture practices that happened in the Bush administration are not continuing anymore. He said he's not receiving allegations. He received them during the Bush administration on a daily basis, torture, ill treatment, rendition flights to countries that are torturing. Although Nowak criticized the Obama administration for not pursuing allegations of torture against the Bush administration, and he cites the Convention Against Torture, which actually creates an obligation for countries who have ratified that convention, and we have, to investigate and prosecute every allegation of torture where there is evidence to support it. Now, another thing that Nowak said is, and actually this is not, I guess it is linked to a story by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism that also quotes Nowak, but the Obama government actually handed over thousands of detainees to the Iraqi government despite the fact that it knew that the Iraqi government was torturing them. Detainees were being whipped with cables, chains, wire, pistols, burnt with acid and cigarettes, having electric shocks to their genitals, fingernails ripped off, fingers cut out, being sodomized with bottles, hoses, and raped. And yet in July of 2010, the Obama administration completed the handover of 9,250 detainees to the Iraqi authorities. This violates our law because the Convention Against Torture makes it very clear that no country should expel or extradite or hand over anyone to another country where there are substantial grounds to believe they'd be in danger of torture. Also, Obama is preventing any litigation by victims of extraordinary rendition using the same state secrets privilege that the Bush administration used, saying we can't litigate that, people being sent to other countries and being tortured, because it's a state secret, even though the program is out in the open. There is no state secret. And he's actually taken that position in a couple of cases, extraordinary rendition cases, of Maher Arar and Binyan Mohammed. He is also, Obama is also pursuing a policy that goes even beyond the Bush administration, and there is information that he is about to sign an executive order allowing indefinite detention, allowing people to be locked up with no charges against them forever. And it's very clear in our law that when there is probable cause to believe that somebody's committed a crime, they should be tried for that crime, or they should be released. And yet there are, and most of the people have been released from Guantanamo, fortunately, after many of them having served many, many years there, many of them being tortured and abused and going on hunger strikes, which, and then force-fed, which amounts to torture. But the U.S. officials have admitted that many of them are innocent, don't have any connection to terrorism. Many of them were picked up by the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan or Pakistan and sold as bounty to the U.S. military for $3,000 or $5,000. And then they were brought to Guantanamo, you know, strapped to the bottom of the plane after having goggles put on them, hoods put over their heads, suppositories to knock them out. And there has been torture documented at Guantanamo. Now, Obama said he would close Guantanamo shortly after his inauguration, but Congress has been using it as a political football. They don't want any detainees released in the United States, even though they have been found to be innocent, many of them. And so there are these people that are hanging in Never Never Land, in limbo, and Obama evidently intends to sign an executive order saying they can be held indefinitely, which violates another treaty we've ratified, which is part of U.S. law, and that's called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So it's the ACLU put out a very interesting report in July of last year, which says that the conclusion is, and it documents, the fact that the Obama administration is continuing many of the worst policies of the Bush administration. I think that should give us all pause.
Exactly. We're talking with Marjorie Cohn, the editor of a terrific new anthology, The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. One final question, Marjorie, and it has a lot to do with what you've just been talking about, the question of accountability. You know, that these business-suited torturers can, in fact, be held accountable. There's a lot of basis for them to be held accountable for what they're doing. And you mentioned in the book one thing that's mentioned in one of the essays, and you talk about it in your introduction, the idea of universal jurisdiction. And it seems very important, given all this stuff about what Obama's doing and the rest of this, and what's been done under the Bush regime, what Obama's continuing. You know, and there are actually efforts in various places to bring these torturers to justice. Can you talk about universal jurisdiction and the efforts to actually prosecute and convict some of these torturers and the people behind it?
Yes. If the U.S. government persists in refusing to bring these people to justice, the people who authorized the torture, the lawyers who gave them legal cover, and the interrogators who carried out the torture, then other countries will bring them to justice under this very well-established doctrine of universal jurisdiction. It's been used by the United States, it's been used by Israel, it's been used by many countries. And the doctrine is based upon the fact that some crimes are so atrocious, they're crimes against all of humanity, and any country can punish foreign nationals for crimes that have nothing to do with that country. So, for example, Israel convicted, and executed Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct connection with Israel. The United States prosecuted and sentenced Chucky Taylor of Liberia to 97 years, about 2 years ago, and he is serving time now in a federal prison for torture in Liberia that had nothing to do with the United States. Now, Spain is investigating six of the Bush torture lawyers for torture, and although they've weakened their universal jurisdiction law, that investigation is pending. So if John Yoo and Jay Bybee and David Addington and William Haynes and Douglas Feith and Alberto Gonzalez decide they want to go take a trip to the French Riviera, they have to think twice about it, because if there are charges eventually filed in Spain or in any other country for that matter, and there are extradition treaties between these countries, then they could be scooped up and brought for trial into a foreign country.
All right, Marjorie, we're going to have to wrap this section of the interview up, and we'll be talking with Lance Tapley very soon. And I wanted to remind people that Marjorie Cohen is the editor of a fantastic new anthology called The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And it includes essays by people like Richard Falk, Terry Lynn Carl, John Lango, Jane Meyer, Alfred W. McCoy, Sister Diana Ortiz, Bill Quigley, Michael Ratner, and Philippe Sands, and many others. And it's a really, really, it's in a book that it's imperative for anybody who cares about what's going on in the world today to pick up and to read and to get it out among your friends, to carry out discussions. This is the kind of book that people can actually organize salons around and discuss the critical questions that are raised in here. So Marjorie, once again, thank you very much for pulling this all together.
My pleasure, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon now.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Marjorie Cohen, the editor of an important new anthology published by New York University Press, and that is The United States and Torture. You know, when I was talking to Marjorie, she told me a funny little story, and actually a very revealing story. She said she initially wanted to name the book The United States of Torture, but her publishers insisted that she change the title to The United States and Torture. You know, establish that little bit of distance between reality and what they tell us, okay? That's what's going on. And I can't say enough about how important I think this book is and how much I'd really like to see everybody reading it and talking about it. It's way past time that we all understood that if we stand silent in the face of all this, or simply refuse to even recognize these terrible war crimes committed by this system, then we're not just supporting what goes on, we're contributing to it. I don't know, call me inflexible here, but as far as I'm concerned, that's unacceptable. We're going to take a musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Lance Tapley, one of the contributors to The United States in Torture. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was The Slackers with International War Criminals from their album of the same name. Now, some of you may recall we played that song last week, but it's such a powerful song and so appropriate to our discussion today, I decided I just had to play it again. So enjoy it while you got it. Coming up later in the hour, we'll hear a brief piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on what it means to live in a world of rape and sexual assault. Joining us now is one of the contributors to the United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, and that's Lance Tapley. Lance is a freelance investigative journalist. He's a political writer for the Portland Phoenix in Maine, and his series on torture in Maine's Supermax prison won a national first place award from the Association of Alternative News Weeklies. Lance, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start off with this. Your piece, Notes from the Supermax Prisons, your piece in this anthology, opens up with the statement that the American prison system has become a monster. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are an exceptional nation, as you know, and we are the world torture champions in what happens in our prison system. That's qualitatively. Quantitatively, we have, of course, the biggest prison system in the world. We have 4.5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. We have in our five times the world average incarceration rate. 2.3 million people behind bars. Two-thirds of them are black or Hispanic. I could go on. Our incarceration rate is four times what it was in 1980.
Well, one of the things that you say, though, in relation to all this is that beyond the blossoming, the mushrooming of imprisonment in U.S. society, that there's actually been something over the last few decades that was formed up, a network of supermax prisons that are not only extraordinarily cruel, but in fact constitute a network of mass torture unique in the world and in history. Can you explain that?
Well, that is a pretty big claim, I realize. Supermax prisons are, well, supermax stands for super maximum security. And they feature solitary confinement, and they feature total control, and lots of harshness. There's a basic sort of idea here that one must be exceptionally harsh with the people in these prisons. And there are, estimates vary, but there are at least 36,000 and upwards of 75 to 100,000, depending on how you want to count it, on how you want to define it. People in these prisons, in the federal, especially the state systems, the county, city, jails, etc. But they're all on the same template, which is super maximum security or supermax. And there is no other country that does this. I mean, there's an occasional supermax here and there. But for example, in England and Wales, there are 75,000 prisoners. There are about 40 people who might be considered to be in this category of imprisonment there.
You know, it was interesting because I noticed that you said even in places that the U.S. is always very fond of pointing to is for their various dungeons and prisons, including Nazi Germany, that the question of actually isolation and this kind of treatment was very rare.
Well, for one thing, it's expensive. It's two or three times the expense of general population imprisonment. And, you know, people in other countries just apparently weren't willing to do that. I'm sure that if the Nazis had thought of it and they felt they had the money, they would have done it. But we've done it. And it's, you know, it's a mass torture that I haven't been able to find any historical parallel to, and certainly there's no parallel in other countries. I mean, we in this country spend a lot of time talking about the human rights violations in other countries, and, of course, there are a number of people rightfully upset with what has happened at Guantanamo and before that at Abu Ghraib. But we really don't have yet a consciousness that is widespread in this country about the really big crime in terms of this torture sweepstakes, if you will, which is the supermax prisons in the U.S.
And you just think about it. That's the good old American spirit, you know, the spirit of American capitalism. We not only thought about it, but damn it, we did it. You know, and you think about what that's saying about the nature of this society and what it's unleashed on the world in the sense of this being unparalleled and unprecedented in a big way. And, you know, one of the things you talk about in here is this also parallels a lot to what the U.S. is doing internationally. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, Bradley Manning recently, his imprisonment in solitary confinement has brought this issue more to the fore, and I've noticed that on news sites and blog sites, people are starting to talk about what's happening in this country. He is in a military prison, but you know, we've had this concern about what's among many people in the special prisons, for example, at Guantanamo and at rendition sites and so forth, that the military and the CIA have had, but we just haven't had much of a consciousness. But I think this consciousness is growing, and people are starting to say, why are we doing this? And that's a very big question.
You bring up Bradley Manning, and one of the things you do in your essays, you focus on two forms of torture. One is the cell extractions, which I think if you could talk to a little bit and just let people know what they are. And the other is the forced isolation, and you actually, the solitary confinement, and you describe that as the worst form of torture inflicted on Supermax prisoners. Can you speak to those two things?
Well, cell extractions are when you do something that the guards don't like. For example, if you maybe paste something over the tiny window in your steel door to your cell, and they can't see what you're doing, or you refuse to put your hands through the food slot, you're fed through the slot, that you don't really have any contact normally with other human beings. Or you might even just curse out a guard, and then they send in a team, a kind of SWAT team, and they knock you down, and they put ankle shackles on and handcuffs on, and they drag you out off, and they'll cut your clothes off, and they'll take you down the cell block to the restraint chair room and put you in the restraint chair to cool you off. This often damages prisoners greatly. I mean, this is very bad physically, but you know, a lot of people have the ability to recover from physical harm, but it's very difficult to recover from the psychological harm that solitary confinement inflicts. And there's been a massive body of medical literature on solitary confinement for 150 years, actually, because it was tried in the 19th century and it was abandoned. And it just makes people psychotic. About three quarters of the prisoners get mentally damaged. A lot of them, you know, have paranoia, hallucinations, even catatonia. It becomes a very bad problem for many prisoners. And this is something that, as I say, you know, you can be pretty sure if you have any prolonged solitary confinement, it's going to hit a very large percentage of prisoners. It's a sure thing.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking now with Lance Tapley, who's an investigative journalist, and he's one of the contributors to this really good new anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, edited by Marjorie Cohn. And Lance's article in this anthology is Mass Torture in America, Notes from the Supermax Prisons. Now, Lance, one of the things when you're talking about this, I was kind of struck by, even with the cell extractions, the idea that some of the people you interviewed as part of your article, you said that sometimes they are extracted from their cells five times a day.
Well, that is kind of a record. I put that in because this one fellow that I interviewed had that happen to him. He sort of was the record holder in the main state prison. But these are common. I mean, these go on a daily basis in supermaxes all over the country. And the idea is total control. I mean, that's what the solitary confinement is about. But when these people who may not be nonviolent and may not have really done anything to in any rational way deserve it are taken out of their cell, they have to have a guard on either side. I mean, this is, for example, if they're just going to have a shower, a guard on either side, they have to have shackles on their ankles, and they have to have handcuffs, and they're sort of goose-stepped down the corridor to the shower room. I mean, these are people who may be in prison for something like fraud or burglary, and who may have no history of violence. And you know, the biggest common denominator in supermax prisons is mental illness. People who can't follow the rules of the prison. It's a prison within a prison, so they're put in the supermax. In the main state prison, for example, there are several people there who got themselves tattooed. And, you know, for one reason or another, they were caught in the act, and they're thrown into solitary confinement. That it has become the way to deal with anything you don't like if you're a guard or if you're a prison official.
I interviewed somebody a couple weeks ago who was had done an investigation of the supermax prisons in California and solitary confinement and how they work. And one of the things that she was bringing out was that while basically a lot of the prisoners there are considered the worst of the worst, and you speak to this too, but actually when you look at it, there is a tremendous percentage, as you're saying, of mentally ill people. There's people who just are rebellious. And she was pointing out that even though that the percentage these days, it's not like it was in the 60s and 70s where the percentage of political prisoners was much higher, but that when you look at the number of people who are actually being held in solitary confinement in these supermax prisons, quite a high percentage of them, given the low percentage of them in relation to the overall prison population, quite a high percentage are in the supermax prisons and in forced isolation.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, political prisoners. A lot of the people in supermax are there because they have been dissident in one way or another within the prison. I mean, they may have protested conditions in some fashion. They may have stood up for another prisoner. They may have in some way alienated the officials. So this is where they go. In that sense, they are political prisoners. The prisoner who turned me on to what was happening in the supermaxes as his reward, sent out of state to try to get him out of my clutches and out of the clutches of the rest of the news media, and put into a supermax in Baltimore. And he, you know, there was no reason. The guy never had any history whatsoever of violence or escape or anything else. It was just simply that's the way they deal with them.
One of the things that was also brought out here, and as you talked about this, the idea that, again, so many of the prisoners in supermax and in isolation are actually mentally ill to begin with. There was a big scandal in California regarding the treatment of these mentally ill prisoners in these special management units, where they actually, when they go for therapy, for instance, that the ones that are allowed to go for therapy find themselves sitting in a little boxed cage, chained up, and their therapist is sitting across the room out of spitting distance and whatnot, and talking to them through this box, you know. And if they have group therapy, the guy's surrounded by a circle of boxes talking to prisoners chained in individual boxes. And this is the kind of treatment that people get, which is, again, forced isolation, even within forced isolation. It's just bizarre and barbaric.
Well, think about it. How can you give therapy to people who are 99% of the time in a situation, solitary confinement, that's driving them crazy?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I mean, so therapy becomes a fraudulent gesture. It becomes a bureaucratic fraud. In Maine, what they do is they have a mental health worker go a couple times a week to the door, the cell door, of which is a solid steel cell door of the supermax prisoner, and the mental health worker yells through the food slot, and of course there's no privacy, which is kind of an important aspect of any psychological therapy, to the prisoner for a few minutes, and he may or may not yell something back. So it's just absurd.
Yeah, actually, that's the thing, as you think about this, including the fact that they're in a situation that is literally driving them insane. And I'd like to talk about that just a little bit, because it gets into the question of Bradley Manning. It also gets into what happened to Jose Padilla a long time ago, who was kept in total isolation, and eventually his brain melted is what's been reported, where he was just incapable of even carrying on, of recognizing the difference between reality and illusion. You know, and that's a very serious situation. And they are keeping Bradley Manning in isolation, are they not?
They are, and I don't know the details, but apparently he's not even allowed to exercise within his cell. So it's a very particular kind of isolation.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Lance Tapley, a contributor to the United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, an anthology edited by Marjorie Cohen about torture outside the borders of the U.S. and inside in the supermax prisons, which is what Lance's article concentrates on. Let me ask you one more question, Lance, and then we'll move on. But you cite George Orwell in his book 1984 saying the object of torture is torture. And I thought that was really important, because it brings us right back to the morality issue. There's never a justification for it. And indeed, a lot of times they say people can say the purpose of torture, while it's not easily quantified, has more to do with instilling fear and establishing total control. That's true. But there's actually something much more basic to it in terms of morality, I think.
Well, yeah, and I think we all have to look at this. I think we're all complicit in this. I mean, I didn't know a thing about what was going on until 5 years ago, when this prisoner, through an intermediary, got in touch with me. And you know, we have to ask, why is it that some people are upset about Guantanamo, but they're not upset about what's going on in the supermaxes? And then that immediately takes you to the question of why are we engaged in the larger prison madness, putting so many people in prison for such long terms for, in many cases, nonviolent crimes. We're the only country that does this, as I cited. The statistics are absolutely amazing. And the people who've looked at this, the scholars and activists who spent the most time on this question, including a lot of prisoners, of course, they see racism and they see classism. I've come to that conclusion. In Maine, we don't have many minorities, for example, and most of the people in the prison, therefore, are white people, but they're all very poor, or nearly so, nearly all of them. And you know, we've got to look at how we're dealing with the people at the bottom in terms of the economic structure if carefully. And if we do, I think we'll see that we're dealing with a lot of them by putting them in prison. And then, you know, the prison within the prison for those people who, one way or another, can't deal with the rules of the prison. And as I mentioned, they may be mentally ill too. Those people are the people who get this incredible harshness. And you know, there's so, it's such a complex issue. I mean, we've had this harshness in a historical context for the past 30 years, and you have to look at the political atmosphere. You have to look at also what we did in terms of the country did in terms of basically tearing down the mental health structure, but not putting a good community mental health system in its place, and so the prisons have become the de facto asylums. You have to look at the media, sensationalism about crime, which a lot of opportunistic politicians have taken advantage of. You have to look at the war on drugs. About 20% of the people in prison are there because of that, on and on. And then, of course, when you develop this sizable prison industrial complex, if you will, and it's not just private prisons. That's a small part of it, really. It has to do with the public system. Then you've got a lot of investment right there. So we have to ask ourselves a lot of questions. It's a complex issue, but at the same time, you can come to, I think, to some simple conclusions about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think actually one of them is, which is not so simple, but is definitely true. When you think about this, I mean, I think the point you were raising about who's being mainly bearing the brunt of all this and who's it being targeted against. When you put together what you were saying, even about the, when the supermaxes began with the tie-in with the mushrooming of the prison population, and you think about that, you know, the Reagan era and the war on drugs when that began, Michelle Alexander's book really just stunningly documents how that, this mushrooming of the prison population to such a gigantic number and mainly focused on Black people and then Latino people, but mainly when you look at it, the numbers of Black people forced into jail these days as routine. So you have whole sections of youth who think, look, you know, it's just you grow up expecting you're going to do some time in jail. And then what happens in terms of this social control, this dehumanization, and what Michelle argues is the formation, it's part and parcel of the formation of a new Jim Crow within this country.
Right, but what I'm saying is, it's basically, you know, an oppression of a class of people. I mean, and many of those people, of course, are Blacks and Latinos. But it's an oppression of the poor, I think, basically. And you know, you talked about the harshness of the conservative element in our political world have got the American people to accept, but one thing that you should understand and that your listeners should understand is that this was all accepted by the liberals. The liberals have really only recently have they started to become concerned about the prisons, in at least in any numbers of them. I mean, the liberal politicians throughout the past 30 years have basically not uttered a peep.
A quick reminder, we're talking with Lance Tapley, who is one of the contributors to a new anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, edited by Marjorie Cohn. Yeah, I don't disagree with you there, Lance, and I think it's extremely important to point out, and I think it's extremely important for people to understand that that there needs to be some outrage, damn it. You know, there really needs to be some outrage around this, and I just don't think people can sit back and allow this to go unspoken to.
I think there actually is starting to be a larger consciousness of this, and you know, obviously Bradley Manning, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, that's increasing the consciousness of what is torture and what the United States does, and there is more activism in terms of groups like the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, which was only focused on U.S. torture outside the country, and now adopting supermaxes as a cause, a campaign against torture within this country is what they have adopted, and so has the American Civil Liberties Union as well, and other groups. So there is a greater consciousness of this. In Maine, we've had a bill in the legislature, which didn't succeed this first time around, but it's going to come around again, to limit solitary confinement to 45 days and not allow seriously mentally ill people to be in solitary confinement. Within the Supermax prison in Maine, for example, the figure is 50% of the people there are officially classified as seriously mentally ill. So that would do a large, that if that bill passed, it would do make a large gesture toward emptying the supermax. In Illinois, there's also a big campaign against supermax imprisonment, and there have been some success stories brought about through litigation. For example, the ACLU took on the state of Mississippi, and they got Mississippi in a settlement of a lawsuit to reduce its supermax population considerably. New York, there have been some successes too. So this consciousness is increasing. There's more political activism, and you know, despite the dark vision of this situation that I perhaps portrayed in our interview, I think that there is some cause for optimism.
Okay, Lance, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sure,
very much,
and
too.
Congratulations on being part of this this very important book, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, something I think that will really contribute to raising the consciousness around what is going on around torture internationally and inside the borders of the U.S. as well. So once again, Lance, thank you very much for joining us today.
And thank you.
Okay, take care now.
Bye.
Bye. That was Lance Tapley, an investigative journalist and one of the contributors to the book, The United States and Torture. Well, we're creeping up on the end of the show, but before we pull out of here for the week, I wanted to play a piece from Bob Avakian's talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Now, this piece has some very special meaning today, since we're talking in the vicinity of the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirt Factory Fire, and this terrible event itself was the catalyst for the beginning of International Women's Day, and that was 100 years ago. And, you know, ever since then, especially these days, we keep getting told that, hey, maybe women have it bad in other parts of the world. Maybe women have it bad in those backward countries in the third world. But you know what? Here in the U.S. and in other imperialist countries, women actually have it pretty damn good. You know, we're told that all the time. Now, this piece by Bob Avakian is on living in a world of rape and sexual assault. And if ever there was a clear reason why revolution is indeed necessary, this is it. So take a listen.
Think of this fact. Between 1/4 and 1/3 of all women in the U.S. will be raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. A woman is raped almost every minute in this country. Now, this makes me think of something that the great African-American novelist and writer Richard Wright put into the beginning of one of his books, Big Boy Leaves Home. It's a story also that begins in the rural South. It's a story of some young black boys who go out for have a little fun one day. They go down for a walk by the river. They're having fun with each other the way kids do. They're laughing and playing. They're walking along the edge of the river, and all of a sudden they take a turn in the river, and there is a white woman bathing in the river. And suddenly they're struck with terror, because they know, through no fault of their own, and purely by the accident of making that curve in the river, their lives are now in danger, that they could be lynched just for coming upon this white woman in this way. And this same kind of situation exists for women throughout this society. You go shopping. Maybe you have to go at night because you work during the day. You come out of the store. If the lights aren't working in the parking lot, or if you're parked in the wrong place, you have a real fear of being attacked and raped. If you're walking down the street and there's a place there that's a little bit hidden where somebody could be hiding, you have a real fear of being attacked and raped. If you go the wrong place at the wrong time, or if you do something that some asshole says means you asked for it, you could be attacked and raped. Now, Elaine Boozler is a comedian. She got at this point in a way of using humor to illustrate a very serious and deadly thing. She told about how, in one of her routines, she told about how she came out of a movie with a male friend of hers, a good friend, and he said, "Oh, it's a beautiful night. Why don't we go for a walk down by the river?" And she said, "Well, maybe it's safe for you, but I don't think I'm going for a walk down by any river. It's late at night, it's dark, and I'm carrying a vagina." Now, this is a way to use humor to make a deadly serious point. And another cold statistic captures a real horror lived by women every day. A woman is battered in the U.S. every 15 seconds. And by far, this is done most often by their boyfriends or husbands, who have been trained and conditioned to view these women not as equal partners, but as something like their property, their possession, and a breeder of their children. for most of the time the United States has existed, and even within the lifetimes of many people still alive today, there were laws in many states in the U.S. which, in terms of the rights of persons, did not include women in the category of persons with these rights. And these laws and the customs that went along with them openly treated women as inferior and subordinate to their husbands and to men in general. As I pointed out in the book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, up until less than 20 years ago, there were still states in the U.S. where there was no such thing as marital rape, where a husband could legally force his wife to have sex with him whether she wanted to or not. And for most of the history of this country, this was a situation for wives in general. And then there is the move, backed and encouraged from the highest offices of the land, to keep cutting back and ultimately to take away from women the right to have an abortion. Upholding and fighting for the right of abortion is a crucial part of fighting for the emancipation of women in the fullest sense. It is a crucial part of freeing women from every form of domination and oppression by men, breaking the chains on half the human race, enabling women to take part fully and equally in every sphere of society, and in the struggle to radically change all of society. Denying women the right to abortion, denying them the right to decide when or if they will have children, with everything that means and all the effects that will have on their lives. Denying this is like battering and rape. Denying the right to abortion is a means of exercising forcible control by a male supremacist society over the very lives of women and over their bodies.
Welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. If you want to hear the speech revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about in its entirety, just scoot on over to revolutiontalk.net. Well, that just about wraps up our show for the week. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And I want to thank all of my guests, Marjorie Cohn and Lance Tapley. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in, and keep on coming back. Each and every week, you know where to find us. We're right here on the intersection of epistemology and morality. This is the spot where we understand that it's not acceptable to not believe something because it makes you uncomfortable. And it's not acceptable to believe something because it makes you feel comfortable. It's not enough to do good in a bad world. We got to fundamentally change the whole damn thing. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Hell from James Brown. That's right.
Hit it. To hell. To hell. We've got some